Hey women! By women, I mean adult human females. There's a new event called RISE, Reigniting Intergenerational Sisterhood Everywhere, which will take place on the land, the original Michigan Women's Music Festival land, this July 30th through August 4th. Workshops will include topics in intergenerational lesbian community building, feminist and political organizing, continuing the legacy of the women's movement, and intersectional approaches. We aim to build trust through open sharing and respectful listening in this focused, intimate setting. Aside from the core programming, RISE offers the chance to bond in person with other women during concerts, dances, movies, coffeehouse, open mics, skill shares, and swaps. We each bring our energy and gifts to the land and leave with new friends, skills, and ideas. Ticket sales end on Sunday, July 21st. No tickets will be sold at the gate. RISE is for adult human females only, and all applicants will be vetted. To apply, please email Char, that's C-H-A-R, at riseontheland2020s@gmail.com. That's riseontheland, all one word, lowercase, no space, 2020s@gmail.com. Please tell her you heard about it on Heterodorks. That will help us learn whether this PSA is effective. Thanks!
Heterodorks! Heterodox dorks!
Hey, TERFs and trannies! You're listening to yet another episode of Heterodorks. I am your co-host, Nina Paley, a canceled artist.
I am Corinna Cohn, your other co-host, and my friends can call me Corey.
Aw, and so can Lionel Shriver.
Yes, and Lionel Shriver can spell my name however she would like to. And, you know, although, Nina, I got to object for a moment, because isn't Lionel a man's name?
Well, yeah, so's Corey. So's Corinna, apparently.
So's Corinna. And if I called myself Nina, that would also be a man's name.
Correct.
But if I called myself J.D. Haltigan, that would be somebody else's name. Our guest this week. Welcome, J.D.
Well, pleasure to be with Heterodorks Podcast. I've been looking forward to this discussion for quite a while, so it's great to be with you both.
Thank you. I'm not sure the best way to introduce you, because I know that you have worked in academia as a professor, but that is in the past and maybe again in the future. But how do you describe yourself? How do you identify?
I would say right now I'm an independent scientist. You know, you said it beautifully there. I was in academia, a professor in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Toronto. And in psychiatry, as opposed to psychology, you basically serve appointments. So you're appointed. And once my contract ended, that ended my appointment. So this all occurred, of course, at the same time that some of the, what we'll discuss, the woke lunacy that we're living through was emerging, and me being a certain personality type and speaking out against some of the madness doesn't lend itself well to remaining in academia in the first place right now. So it was a little difficult to continue on where things are bonkers. And so I'm originally from the States, the U.S., so I came back here, and I'm currently hoping that something will fall through where I can continue to do scientific research, because I put a lot of effort into it. And it's really my passion to study psychology and psychiatry. So currently scrambling around, trying to make it work, working a little part-time work and a blue collar job and applying to different places, and hopefully something will break here soon with the pushback that we're seeing to some of the wokeness that's occurring. So it's an encouraging time, but you have to really make a decision whether you're going to speak out or not. And if you do, you have to just roll with those consequences for right now. So independent scientist, if you really want to boil it down, is how I would answer my question. Sort of emerging public intellectual trying to build my social platform and get back into a institutional setting.
It's sort of another way of saying you're a gentleman of leisure.
Correct. In a blue-collar job.
Right. Although at this point, I would say that it's forced leisure rather than a preferred leisure, because I really do aspire to work and publish and analyze data. So I'm doing a little bit of that right now with some projects that were left hanging, but you really need to be in a position where you can have institutional support and colleagues who see the world the same way you do. So,
what kind of data are you analyzing right now?
I have a current paper that I'm writing with some colleagues that looks at the original Bangladesh mask RCT, which was has to do with COVID masking and whether or not masks reduce COVID spread at the population level. So that data was public access. So we wanted to go back in and reanalyze that and try to make a case that masks really don't work to prevent COVID spread, which I think is pretty much readily understood right now, now that we're in the rear view of COVID. But that involves a lot of data wrangling and getting the data from the original study in, and the analysis that we wanted to do was fairly complex. So you have to write code and so forth. And then there's a meta-analysis that I've been doing with some students and people that I've worked with around what I call heart rate variability. So that requires a lot of literature searching and coding that data, coding those studies, compiling all that information. So hopefully if I get back into an institutional setting, I can really pick that work back up in earnest and keep moving forward. But that requires a lot of, you have to stay in the mix with data. You lose the ability to code. Anybody that's coded ever knows that, writing code for programs, you have to stay in the mix. And it's the same with data.
How does the COVID masking relate to psychology? I mean, how does its efficacy to prevent or not prevent COVID?
The link, that's a great question. The link there for me was people still mask and they believe in masks. And that gets down to what is, you know, personality traits and personality psychology and personality psychopathology, which is essentially, you know, neuroticism and anxiety and sort of the more highly anxious population will mask to feel safe. It's like a psychological comfort mechanism. And they will continue to do so even in the face of evidence that points that masks don't work. Obviously, in some cases, in very unique, rare situations, masks in a hospital setting or in a very highly controlled environment where someone is really sick might be warranted. But with COVID, what we saw was, and I wrote a piece on my Substack about this, was, you know, really a personality psychopathology that emerged during this time that was reflected at the population level, and people really noticed around neuroticism and other personality traits that gave rise to highly vigilant behaviors when it became quite evident that COVID was a minor, frankly, a low risk for most people type of virus.
Have you ever studied bike helmets?
And I have not studied bike helmets, but I'm aware peripherally of that discourse around that. Yeah.
Yeah, I have a post that I've never put online from 2020, but the title is Masks, Bike Helmets for Your Face.
Yep, that makes sense. A lot of people refer to masks as anxiety napkins, sort of more, a little bit more of a less nice way of putting it. But yes, absolutely the same logic with bike masks or bike helmets.
Now, that said, I have a wacky COVID story. I'm one of these people. I guess I'm an outlier. I got a lot sicker from COVID than anyone I know, and I ended up developing Crohn's disease and also some autoimmune skin conditions. So now I'm taking immunosuppressants. And since I started getting these infusions, I started masking in, like, when I go to the grocery store. And that's not just for COVID, that's for like anything. And it's not like I believe that I'm not going to get something, but yeah, it's like a complex social thing or psychological thing. It's like, well, this might work, this might not work, but I will reproach myself more if I get sick. It's kind of like belief in God, you know? I just really wanted to get my infusions because Crohn's disease is really, really unpleasant and difficult. And I really wanted to do what I could to get better. And I was like, I'm just going to mask in the grocery store so I don't get COVID or a cold or whatever. Or maybe I will get these things, but I'm like, being immunosuppressed now, I'm in this different class of people now.
Right. And I think you put it well there. You're in a different class of people. So in your situation, it's a little more warranted and a little more readily understandable why you would do something like that, with those details in mind that you just, you know, you just mentioned. And I'm sure some people that are masking even now are probably similar cases. But during COVID, what we saw was a much more widespread situation where many people who were not nearly in the same boat as you were just masking for other reasons completely. And even in your case now, you demonstrated just in what you said is that you have a cognitive understanding that it is, in a way, somewhat of a talisman, if you will.
Yes.
You're not wearing a mask with this sort of absolute belief that it's going to protect you from everything. It's not an existential thing per se.
Yeah. I wear bike helmets so that people don't yell at me.
There you go. Yeah. So it's more of a social fitting in. I mean, do you believe if people weren't yelling at you, would you be wearing bike helmets?
No.
Because why?
Because the type of bikes that I ride, these helmets are not tested for, and the types of impacts that I'm likely to have, they are vanishingly unlikely to give me any protection.
And that's a proportional risk assessment that is completely sensible. And that's exactly what we saw in COVID, which was the reverse, is that these risk assessments were totally off the rails and they were nonsensical rather than sensical, like which is what you just demonstrated there. You recognize that the risk is minimal. You're not going to waste your time with something that otherwise would be uncomfortable or useless for you, aside from so that you don't get yelled at.
Yeah, but bike helmets protect me really, really well from other people yelling at me to wear a bike
Correct.
Helmet.
Well, there you go. And that's even an indication that the bike helmet might be doing something that it wasn't even indicated for to fit in.
That's right. They're foam hats. They are a magical foam hat that keep your liberal friends from yelling at you when you ride your incumbent bike.
How would you describe the personality of most bike riders that you are around? What's the typical personality profile of the bike rider?
That's a big question. Can it be multiple choice? Can you give me some choices?
Well, you just said your liberal friends that bike ride, so you kind of alluded to a little bit of it there, but bike riders who are consistently in that hobby of bike riding everywhere, and that's their primary means of transportation, are they like fairly eco-friendly and they view automobiles as polluting the environment, or what's the...
You just JD, described me!
Those people are crazy.
They're crazy. They're so neurotic. They're messed up.
They think the world's end. They think the population is exploding. There's all sorts of neuroses.
We're getting down to the nitty-gritty.
No, most of the people that get upset about me not wearing a helmet are not bicyclists themselves. And there are many bicyclists that wear helmets. Only a small subset of them give others a hard time for not wearing a helmet.
I see.
But
I mean, I've ridden bikes in my youth and certainly, but I'm not what you would call a regular bike rider. Even if I were in a campus setting, I don't think I would be riding a bike regularly.
I don't tend to wear bike helmets, but I do use extra firm hold in my hair before I go out.
Gotcha. So that will protect you because it makes the hair stiffer.
Well, it's better than hitting my... It's the hair protects the head.
Right.
Right. So if you're going to skid across the asphalt, the hair... It's like the dogs that are really shaggy. They have the shaggy hair so that they can't get bit.
It's like a natural form of skid protection.
Absolutely.
Gotcha.
Although I think that if you wipe adequately, that's also a natural form of skid protection.
True, true.
All right.
Sorry.
We're devolving.
Why don't
quickly,
I let Corinna drive this? I wasn't intending to say anything. I just got curious. Corinna
no.
shared an article or a book review that you wrote that
yes.
I read. And we're going to talk about that.
Yes. And I think the discussion of bike riding briefly in the personality profile of those who think the world is going to end and catastrophize might lead well into discussion of the book that you read the review of, which we're going to discuss.
Well, the book is called The Denial of Death by Ernest Becker. Can you tell us about it, JD?
Yeah, so it's a classic work by Ernest Becker. It was one in which I was encouraged to read it by my father. And for a while I was sort of recalcitrant to reading it because it was more psychoanalytic, and I'm more of an evolutionary minded psychologist who is studied fairly strongly in what is called attachment theory, which is grounded in evolutionary theory. And so I kind of dismissed Freud and his influence, even though I was aware of it. I kind of dismissed it and put aside the book for quite some time. But finally, I decided to read it because I had gotten into more of, I guess you could call, cultural psychology, primarily as a result of some of the chaos that we're living through, and read people like Philip Reeve, who was a noted cultural psychologist or sociologist, and Christopher Lash, who did some work. And so I read The Denial of Death. It won the Pulitzer in 1973. It's a classic book, and it does draw on psychoanalytic notions, and specifically Freud, but it kind of weaves those in with the waning of religion in a more secular society, even in the late 70s, early 80s, when he wrote the book, and the rise of the therapeutic culture as a replacement for organized religion when that was waning and society was becoming more secular. And one of the things that is interesting about the book for me is that when you read it again and you read Becker's analysis about, you know, people's denial of death as really at the root of a lot of the social and psychological malaise that people experience, you realize that Freud did have some insights, and they were more cultural insights rather than psychological insights. But he understood, in a way, what some of the personality psychopathology that made people a little bit mad and insane. And he understood that if you had no inner fulcrum about who you are and your identity or why you were here, that could lead to quite a bit of trouble for your integration into society. And in reading The Denial of Death, just to finish off here, the analysis is that a lot of what we're living through right now with gender stuff, and more broadly with millennials who have no real idea of who they are in this social media landscape, is a failure to develop a full identity, a full personality identity that is coherent and integrated. And that might be more difficult in the current environment that we're living in, but in reality, it boils down to an existential dread. I mean, you feel, you know, a lot of these millennials fear climate anxiety, and so it really is, at the end of the day, if you have no stable sense of who you are in an environment that's chaotic and mediated a lot by social technology, you may in fact not know it, but you're fearful. You're inherently fearful of existence. It might not necessarily be for a millennial that you're thinking about death in the moment, but you're fearful of existence, how you're going to be evaluated, and who you are. And so there's a sort of a failure of coherent personality integration. And that's kind of the summation of Becker's book, is he realized that there was going to have to be a merging somehow of some sort of religion with some sort of cultural a way of integrating one so that they could really develop a sense of identity and be able to manage their life in a way that led to some sort of optimal functioning in the environment.
I'm really struck by how terrified young people are. They're terrified of me. They're terrified that I and people I associate with literally want them dead for being their true selves. And how do you draw a straight line from that to just garden variety fear of death?
In your example, why do they think that you want them dead? Because you're pushing back against some of the ideology, or?
Yeah, because I keep asserting that biological sex is real, right, and that I say things like women don't have penises. And yeah, they, if I do that and then don't apologize for it, then like I'm an existential threat to them. Like they think that I hate them and that I want to kill them, and that if I don't want to kill them, then the people that I talk to, like you, for example,
sure,
that you would like to see them all dead or vanished.
Erased. Yes. I think there's two classes. I think one class of those people understand that you don't, and it's just sort of a psychopathic personality way of maintaining an ideology that they know is bankrupt and corrupt. But there is another class of people who are terrified. They're highly neurotic, anxious, and they have what I would call a failure to develop a personality identity, that they know who they are. And so when you fall under the sway of an ideology that, you know, at the top of that ideology are coherent, sensible people in the way that they understand it's bankrupt, but they're psychopathic in the sense that they can sort of manipulate others underneath them who are unsure, confused, disoriented. And you can see where that would be quite easy for those types of people to manipulate the ones who really have sort of either a biological or sociological, psychological reason for being unsure about who they are, like trauma or something. You can see where they could be manipulated into believing that someone like you, because they, you know, you state the truth, is some sort of malevolent person. So I think there's two classes of people. The ones that you probably come into contact with are the more confused ones, who have been sort of captured by this idea that if you state the truth, you want to terminate the existence of their life. And they can't separate the delusion they live under from reality. And I think that's kind of where we are with a lot of the gender stuff, is that the people that promote the ideology and that want to see it continue are really manipulating large masses of confused, disoriented young people. And that's what makes it so terrifying to kind of witness, is that people who have other mental illness or have suffered trauma and who are confused about their identity for obvious reasons, and then go into these online spaces or get around others where they're affirmed for sort of stating that they're sort of a different identity, they can really come to believe in this. And it's like a cult. I mean, and I think you both have probably heard it referred to as a cult. But you could say the same thing too for like those who fall under the preaching of climate activists. It's really no different, although the consequences aren't as extreme, but it's the same idea. Their mind is totally captured by somehow this existential fear that if the truth is stated, they're going to, you know, their life is going to be terminated. They're highly anxious. They may not think that they're going to die per se this moment, but they're highly anxious.
JD, can you help me understand better a concept that you mentioned a minute ago, which now that I'm trying to remember what I wanted to say, I'm struggling because it's not a normal term for me, but you said something about having an underdeveloped personality.
So yeah, underdeveloped, it just means that as you age, and especially during adolescence, personality traits have not necessarily stabilized quite yet. So who you are, plus in attachment theory, we have this idea of coherence of narrative. So one's life story. Is it coherent? And can you look back to the past and remember your experience and integrate them in a way that is understandable, and you have a story of yourself that is coherent and makes sense? But what we see in those who especially suffered trauma or abuse or maltreatment, their stories are highly incoherent. So they may in young adulthood describe their life as being great when they were younger, but when you actually query them in an interview, they describe experiences that you and I would consider maltreatment or frank abuse. So the story is incoherent. And so they haven't really integrated past experience into their current functioning. And so attachment theory is really, it's a personality theory in a way, although it's a little bit different from personality psychology in the sense of the big five and extroversion and introversion, but they fit together in the sense that in young adulthood, as you're developing along a turbulent time, particularly when puberty hits for everybody, you have biological variables in play, and you have to integrate the past into the present and sort of move forward into adulthood with some sort of stable sense of who you are and where you came from. And if that doesn't exist, you're vulnerable to what we see on social media and some of the way the gender ideologues play. Yeah. Like I just saw a tweet today, and you may have seen it, where like these mom hugs from pseudo parental figures who want to comfort kids whose identity is in question. Like that's a good example of that. It's playing on that confusion in a way that's manipulative, if that makes sense.
Well, not only does it make sense, but I bet that if you had met me when I was 20 years old, that what you're describing would probably be a pretty decent description of me. But when I think about what you're describing in the terms that you are, since I don't think about young people, teenagers or young adults, in terms of whether or not they have an undeveloped personality, for lay people like me that who are trying to make a judgment about where somebody might be in a developmental state, what might we look for? And obviously affirming people in delusional beliefs is not the way that we would want to help somebody who's in that state. But what can we as adults do to have healthy interactions with somebody who's in this underdeveloped personality state?
Yeah, and I use underdeveloped just as sort of a colloquial term. It's not necessarily a term that's been defined per se. It just means that they haven't really integrated in a way that they've sort of made a coherent, let's just say for purposes of our discussion, a coherent life story of who they are and why they're here per se. You can use the example of trauma as a good example, right? So if you're traumatized and you don't know why this is happening, you might not have a coherent life story at 14, 15 years old, especially if you were physically or sexually abused. I mean, just the world might not make sense, basically. In terms of what you can do, I think what they lack, what an underdeveloped personality lacks, is structure, right? It's underdeveloped. It's flimsy. It's there's no structure. And so the best thing to do is provide a structuring environment for these people to push back against their faulty beliefs and ultimately provide some structure that over time they can cling a hold to and really begin to make sense of meaning. And structure can involve, just like Nina said, like women don't have penises. Like that in its most basic elemental sense is an empirical statement of fact, right? It's structural. There may be, you know, you're trying to kill me by saying that, but at the end of the day, it does provide structure that these young people, or it doesn't have to be young people, but that's who mostly it is these adolescents, they can cling hold to eventually. And I will say this, having worked in a residential setting prior to doing my graduate work, and I was dealing with kids who had, they were in residential for sexual sort of transgressions, if you will. So I was dealing with a specific population, physical aggression and so forth. They might push back initially and say things like, you're trying to kill me, or they just might spite you, but they listen to what you're saying. They will reflect on that on their own time. And I think with a lot of the trans stuff, especially with the detransitioners, that structure that's being provided in some way is why are you starting to see some of the detransitioning. It's providing them a grasp to reality, and they're being able to see this is insane. And so they're detransitioning in the extreme case because they've already transitioned. But in other cases, you're preventing the slip slide into that point of where they do transition or cut off their breasts or do a vaginoplasty or something like that. Structure is really what it's about. Stating the truth, providing consistency and reliability to them. So even if they say, you're trying to kill me, Nina, do you still see them on a regular basis, or do you still engage with them? That's sort of part of the structure, right? Is that you're withstanding some of that pushback. You're withstanding some of their testing of you, if you will. And that's one of the things that the famous British psychoanalyst Donald Winnicott was always about. He worked in residential with these youth who had committed petty crimes and aggression. You go into these residential houses and these kids are unruly and they push back and they say mean things to the therapist. But if you're reliable and consistent and can withstand that, they will eventually see that. And I think the same logic applies to the gender insanity, to be truthful. Because in both cases, there's comorbid mental illness, which is really underlying a lot of it. Trauma, in many cases, especially for gender ideology stuff, and kids, you know, all the kids that I work with in residential had been in environments that were completely traumatic by any reasonable standard. But you also have biological contributions too. So there's an interplay of both, but it's that structure and that withstanding of that insanity that I think eventually will be an aid to putting an end to some of this. Even if in the short term, you have to kind of digest and metabolize some of that toxicity that you experience.
You've talked about the actual people with gender identity issues. I've actually found equally, if not more, insane behavior from the allies of these people, the ones that believe that they're rescuing them or protecting them. So what's up with that?
Well, I think, and I've tweeted about this recently, I'm just, as I glance to my right, I tweeted, it's a perversion of the caregiving instinct, really. In other words, I think a lot of the people that think they're rescuing are the activists who have been captured by the sort of higher level ideological framework that they are in fact rescuing these people, when in fact they're not. They're basically creating a pseudo environment. It's sort of a quasi Munchausen syndrome by proxy in a way. I mean, it's not the physical abuse that's being perpetrated for their own attention and so forth, but by claiming rescuer status for these kids who are being erased or otherwise would be erased, they're bringing attention to their own need for narcissism and validation that they didn't get. So if you look at some of these people that are rescuers, I would imagine and predict that if you look back into their own life histories, you're going to see trauma, or you're going to see some sort of role reversion of parental relationships and other contributions to why they're behaving that way. I think at the highest level, like let's say a Jack Turbin, you both probably know that name, I think that person is more psychopathic in a way, because they know what they're doing is insane. I couldn't say clinically whether you can, you know, but it's those types of people who can influence the sort of malleable, empathetic personality to really come to believe that they are rescuers in a sense. So I think it's a perversion of this, you know, most normal, and you see in the gender stuff, it's mainly women. And I say that just to state the fact, right? It's, you don't see men being the rescuers. It's largely driven by women, because they have a proclivity to be caregiving, to be empathetic. And if you hijack that and guilt them, it can spiral totally out of control, which is where I think we are. Does that make sense in my description of that?
Yeah, I do know men though. And I'm thinking about like the men that I know that are like this, they work in schools.
They're more feminine, right? They're more feminine men.
I wouldn't say that. I don't really know, but they do work in schools. They work in schools. They're teachers or otherwise work in schools.
And how would you describe their personality overall if you could?
Covert narcissists is how I would describe their personality.
Would you call them flamboyant or artistic?
No.
But they're narcissists, you say?
Yeah.
And what makes you say that?
Covert narcissists.
What makes you say that?
I don't know. Do we have time to talk about anything else today?
Well, just give me some prototype behaviors that lead you to kind of believe they're covert narcissists. I mentioned flamboyant.
I mean, basically, like, you know, you want to harm these children. I'm protecting these children. You are the danger to these children. These children are going to kill themselves because of you. I'm so glad that these children aren't exposed to you. I don't know. Is that covert narcissism? That's just nasty.
Well, what you're describing is these males behaving the same way as the females.
In this respect, yeah, not in other respects, but in this respect. Although, yeah, I don't know. It's funny. I have, because I've been canceled in my town, and the main cancelers were not trans identified. They were usually aunts and uncles or parents of some trans identified person. But the aunts and uncles were pretty bad too. And the men really, like the women did a lot, but the men were like the spokespeople. The men were like the leaders. And then the women, I guess, carried out a lot of it.
That makes some sense. I mean, in a way, the women are the ones that are going to be the activists and the ones that carry it out. It's not exclusively a female-driven thing. I'm saying it's disproportionately.
Sure.
But I would be interested more, you know, later on, if you had a real sense of what makes you say these men are narcissists, you know, covert narcissists. I have a feeling that if we were to measure them on, say, the dimensions of masculinity, femininity, they would come down much more on the femininity side with their personality traits than the masculine side. And, you know, there might be an exception to that rule, but that's kind of what I'm getting at, is that they're not what you would call masculine men in the sense that they're going to be playing athletics or sports or being in the wrestling ring. They're different than that.
They're going to play fantasy football.
Right. Fantasy football, or even some might be more like gamers, or you're not non-traditional men in the sense of not what you would consider the prototype Paul Bunyan or Davy Crockett, if you will.
Well, one that I'm thinking of is like a hippie Paul Bunyan.
Yeah, hippie. Hippie is artistic, more feminine, poetic, soft, words, language-based. So yeah, hippie would make sense.
I feel like I'm being attacked. That's all I'm saying here.
You do have long hair, Corinna.
I do. And I like art.
And board games. You are a gamer's gamer.
There's definitely overlap and there's variation within and between. So I don't mean to, you know, make exclusive statements, but I'm talking about averages and prototypes.
I don't know. I think Corinna's kind of a feminine man.
Forget that for a second. I don't want to talk about me, but let me ask you something about me. So I had a pretty good discussion with a friend recently who expressed concerns because I'm spending a lot of my time on activism and specifically towards the goal of reducing or eliminating the medicalization of children who believe that they are the wrong gender. And I was accused of, maybe not accused, it was suggested that some of this caretaking or this taking responsibility or control of managing other people might be something that's driving me, and that I'm doing that inappropriately. And when I hear the similar sort of things about the people who I consider my opponents, who sometimes they call themselves mama bears, or meet some of the personality types that you're talking about a little bit, I think, well, maybe I should be alert and try to figure out if some of these things are applicable to the other side. Is this perhaps a trap that I'm not paying attention to and stepping into myself? So whether it's about me or in particular, or whether it might be somebody else who is really invested in this issue and they rationalize it as saying, well, I'm trying to do this to prevent children from being harmed. Is there any exercise that we can do to reflect, to figure out whether we've exceeded our natural boundaries of controlling what we ought to be controlling?
Well, I think you're the fact that you just are asking yourself that question right now is indicative of the fact that you are doing that. And you've had your own experiences where you know what you've been through. So in the case of the other mama bears, they don't have the experience that you do to inform you in empirical reality about the dangers of what you're trying to get others to avoid. And so there's that sort of connection to external reality that you've lived through, integrated into your own personality. Obviously, I'm sure that took some time to do, to reflect upon why and how that fit in. But you're connected to external reality. They're not. And so, yeah, I think it's important to go through the process of what you just described, which in academic parlance is sort of this metacognitive monitoring of, hey, maybe we're being too protective and so forth, but you know that you're not because you've experienced the harm of what happened. And so you're connected to reality in a way that these others are not. But even still, despite that, I think it's still good to check in that way. Obviously, you're not out killing gender ideologues. You know, you're not going out and bombing these facilities that perform gender transitions. So I think,
no,
you're doing it in a way that's functional, understandable, and reasonable.
I am misgendering people, and that can get you locked up in certain
Correct, but you also know that misgendering people and paying the price for that is absolute lunacy. So, you know, and you're connected to that by your connection to the reality of biological sex.
Well, suppose I was one of these mama bears, Nina. I know that's thrilling to you.
That you'd be a mama bear?
Yeah.
You'd be a mama alpaca. Are you switching species again?
I am. It's the species of the week. It's what came up when I rolled the die.
Your species fluid.
Let's say I'm a papa bear. And I have, let's say my son, who was my daughter originally, is receiving these treatments. And I say, that's my connection to my reality, is my offspring is going through this. And I can see now that he's so much happier, and he used to be so reclusive, and now he's social. And I see the Republicans are coming down and trying to chop all this stuff down and trying to make life hard for my kid. I am connected to this, and that is why I'm an activist. Are there questions that you could help somebody ask themselves, or like what would you do to point somebody to become self-reflected, to say, well, have I become toxically empathic at this point? Like how do you help wake somebody up?
You provide them with sort of the prototype examples of setting limits for children. I mean, you don't let children cross train tracks with a train that's speeding forward. You don't allow them to stuff their face with food or always give in to their demands at the supermarket when they throw a temper tantrum. And so I think the prototype dramatic category examples provide some reflectionary possibility for some of these parents that have become overly empathetic, because you can draw on those dramatic examples that any parent would, even if they deny it, readily understand. You know, you don't allow a child to put their hand on a hot burning stove for obvious reasons. And so I think the same applies with this gender ideology. I think most parents at the end of the day, yeah, they might have some doubt that their child is more social and they're better off if they're kind of interacting with a group that affirms their delusion. But I think their instincts in parents would probably trend towards recognizing the reality that something might be amiss. And so if you can trigger them to sort of pay attention to that instinctual feeling and get them to reflect a little bit using those dramatic category examples, that might be a way to start the process. I mean, I think the one prototype example is the kid in the candy store that's throwing the temper tantrum. And do you give in to the demands? No, you have to set limits. You have to set limits as a parent. And I think as a parent, if you can draw on that basic idea of limit setting, which essentially boils down to structural setting, they can at least understand the logic and coherence of that. And now you have also, in addition to that, you have ready examples of the detransitioners whose stories you can present. So it's not just you have to get them to cue in on their instincts. Now you have examples of clear-cut tragic cases where detransition has occurred, which can be really, really useful to show in addition to providing sort of the inroad to reflection that I just mentioned.
They will, of course, do everything they can to discredit those stories, deny them, say that they're huge outliers.
Well, and that's right. Yeah. And you have to, like we just talked a little bit about withstanding and metabolizing that pushback. But now you have, now they're accruing, right? Now you don't just have one or two. You have many high-profile stories. You have legislation that's occurring. And so it's not just sort of the exception anymore. It's starting to trend very quickly as we see some of this pushback. It's starting to trend to be much more the rule now. You're seeing this spill out and the chaos really be uncovered. And so the more this happens and the more that it's amplified on social media, the more it can be useful.
To them, what it does is it seals their belief that people are attacking them and that they're going to die.
I think in the more extreme cases, yes, absolutely. And I think in those cases, there's not much to do I mean, but I think obviously the detransitioners at some point recognized something was wrong. I think some parents at some point recognize something is amiss. They either pause or they're looking for guidance. I think a lot of parents are confused, to be honest with you. I don't have any children of my own or family, but I know a lot of the gender stuff, parents, aside from the ones like you're mentioning, who are committed and who think that if you push back, you're committing genocide against their trans kid, I think many parents are just legit confused with the wealth of information and who to believe. And that's partly because the institutions have become so corrupted. The turban is at a medical institution that pushes this stuff. And so when you have the imprimatur of a medical institution, you know, a parent who's not in medicine or who's not really in academic science is not going to know any better.
Yeah, a lot of people cite science, like Scientific American.
Right. It's become so ideologically captured, it's insane. And it's becoming dangerous. And that's kind of honestly one of the reasons why I want to get back into an institutional setting, is because even despite the fact the institutions are crumbling, the imprimatur of an institution is nonetheless important. And if we don't have any importance attached to these institutions anymore, we're really in a problematic state, because then it's like, you know, who else do you want to believe? I have a PhD. Colin Wright has a PhD. I mean, we both are on the same page, but then Jack Turbin has an MD. So who's the parent going to choose in that case, right? Like, I mean, they're going to have to do their own due diligence. They might not understand terms. And so it's up to sort of really the sort of online discourse at that point. But if you could have an institution that hasn't crumbled, that has legit people, and publishes science that's really the truth around this issue, it's helpful, because then there's at least a guidepost for parents to look at. I think many, even with Turbin, they don't trust that stuff coming out of there. I mean, some may, but we all know online the discourse is that it's totally corrupted and captured, and we can look at any principled scientist can see his research is completely a farce and flawed.
I think it's coming to light that even in the popular media, that anything that concerns this topic that is on the pro side is not subject to fact checking, and that everything that is on the against side is subject to extraordinary fact checking.
Right. And even the fact checkers aren't qualified to do that, right? Like, I mean, I've been trained in statistics and methodology for like literally 20 years. And so if there was any truth to this idea of gender identity, I would be at it. I mean, let me give you a good example. I went into graduate school to study attachment theory, which is basically a theory of nurture, right? It's the idea that parental caregiving shapes who you are, and it shapes how you behave, and it shapes who you become. But over time, and getting really into the nitty-gritty of attachment theory and seeing that it's really grounded in evolution, I've changed in the sense that, yes, nurture is important, but nature's the much more important variable. So, you know, even in the case of extreme nurture or extreme trauma, that certainly plays into who you are. But in the basic normative range, it's genes, it's biology that controls so much of who you are. And that's really hearsay if you're an attachment theorist. And so even within that, I mean, part of my research in my postdoc was sort of really looking into how influential is parental caregiving in youth for later outcome. And one of the things that my advisors had me do was, anytime you do modeling to answer that question, you have to input a biological variable to control for basically a proxy for genetics. If you weren't doing genetic work, you had to include, let's say, psychiatric history of the parents. And so I became to really become a heretic. I mean, even most classical attachment theorists nowadays, the sort of mafia that we call them, the attachment mafia, who are in academia, who are attachment theorists and who have claim to the theory, they would see me as sort of a scoundrel, even though I still believe in the theory, and even though I still believe, as I just discussed with you both, the role of trauma, which is a sort of an environmental input. I don't see any analysis at the end of the day, if you include both nature and nurture, nature's going to basically win out most of the time.
This is good news, though, because we have parents listening, and I think one way of interpreting what you're saying is, parents, you can't screw up bad enough.
Right, unless you're frank, like, you know, in cases of residential, I mean, you saw frank abuse and frank atypical parenting that got to be completely that you can really screw up. But in those cases, the parents themselves are suffering their own psychiatric impairment, whatever the case may be. So at the extremes of parenting, yes, you can screw up. But at the normative level, as Winnicott would say, the good enough parent is the good enough parent. You're going to make mistakes, you know, and you're not going to damage your child just because you didn't affirm their delusional identity one day. It's just not going to happen. And so we don't have institutions where that information is being communicated. And so that's a great loss. And so that's why these podcasts are so important.
Wait, I got to jump. I just had an epiphany. You probably already understand this, but you just connected something for me. You just connected something for me, JD. All of the social emotional learning programs that we do in schools are a proxy for parenting. And if good enough parenting is good enough, we don't actually need social emotional learning programs.
Correct. And not only that, but social emotion, I mean, you've touched on sort of the basic premise of the reality that they're pseudo parenting, but you have to then ask, why are they pseudo parenting? It's to instantiate this sort of equity agenda, which is that if you take a child and you get them to be Play-Doh in a way that they can be empathetic and care about equal outcomes, we can have this sort of world where everybody's the same, and the blank slate is a lie. But yes, it's exactly that. Good enough parenting is fine. You have to set limits. And so the social emotional learning is just a way to butter up kids to really go against their instincts, which are selfish in a way, right? The inherent story that is really true is the selfish gene. And parents socialize that in the context of being good enough. So you don't need social emotional learning. It's an ideological project that propagates, basically, at the end of the day, and it's not a conspiracy theory, it's propagating this equity agenda, which if you really draw it out to the end of the road is this sort of communist logic of equality of outcomes. Because they want kids to think everybody is the same.
I want to talk about the denial of death a little bit again, just to go back to that. So I'm looking at a review here, and you write that the denial of death can be, the central premise is that the denial of death can be boiled down to the nostrum that one's failure to confront the reality of death is at the root of their individual emotional and spiritual development, maladaptation, or personal psychopathology. So a little background, I think I've talked about this on the podcast before, but when I was, how old was I? Early 30s. I ended up being I had the responsibility of making end-of-life medical care decisions for my grandmother. Her two children that were supposed to do that, or two of her children that were supposed to do that, abdicated, and I ended up in that role. And I made the decision to terminate the external breathing apparatus. I removed her life, or gave the order to remove her life support, and she died. And after that, like, as you can imagine, there's a lot of emotional processing that you have to do to reckon with the fact that you, not directly, but almost directly contributed to somebody's loss of life. And after I was done processing that, my own fear of death, my own existential dread just like disappeared. And I was like, oh, that's going to be me one day. I'll die also. And then life for everybody else goes on. And you lay your burdens down and that's it. Like, and I was like, oh, wow, that's actually really easy. Death is actually really easy. It happens. And then everybody else's life continues. And so as long as you're not wasting your own life on trivialities, this is the chance you get. You do as much as you can before your grandchild comes in and removes your life support. And everything like sort of assembled itself and snapped together for me. So when I was reading this essay, I was like, I was such a different person after that. as compared to before it. And reading your review, I was like, how does this happen for other people? Because there's no developmental phase where you end life support for a grandparent, right? There's mortality, or the opportunity of dealing with mortality comes all sorts of different ways, and people deal with it all, like your dead pet or something, right? Or dead parent. But how do people encounter this sort of developmental opportunity and reckon with it generally? And how does it weigh against the current kid glove treatment with which we're dealing with the younger generations that never have to be confronted with any traumas at the level of death?
Well, you just touched on it right there. So it's one, normally in the absence of a situation like yours or the termination, let's say, of a pet, like I've had to put down a pet and kind of, it's sort of a, not obviously a human life, but it's a similar, you know, you're better. Making a decision. Right. But they have to come to that realization through contact with the external environment. Because when you have contact with the external environment, and by external environment, I mean the world before social media, basically, where you were at school, you got bullied, you got picked on, you were touching grass every day, right? And you realize that when you engage the external environment, you're nothing. It's the only thing you have is your story, who you are. You realize in the larger scheme of things, you don't matter except for yourself. And that's what in the review that I wrote of Becker's book, The Causeless Suite Project, is sort of one's own life narrative. What about them is going to transcend when they're gone? And that might be something you write or something you produce. It may be nothing except your legacy of who you are, but it's basically the realization through external contact with reality that it's meaningless for us, aside from developing what we have in the now that can be left for future generations, because life will go on. That one thing we can be sure of, at least in the short term. And even if it's in some sort of evolved, non-human, transhuman form, it's still going to go on. So you have to imagine at least that whoever comes after us is going to have the ability to look back and see what either we produced, or even if we didn't produce anything and you were just sort of the normal person, there's still going to be a story there that somebody will remember, some unique idiosyncratic characteristic of that person. And so that's really the heart of it. The normal person comes to it through external contact with reality, touching grass, but now everybody's living inside their own bubble online. And the young generation, some of them, and I know this for a fact, they don't even leave their apartments on a daily basis. They never go out. Like it's they don't even go out into the external world. I mean, and I'm talking young adults post college, but like they just, they'll get food ordered in. I mean, I don't think people really correctly estimate how dramatic this problem is. And then you have, of course, the overprotection of parents with the young generation. And Abigail Schreier's book touches on this, and I spoke with her when she was writing it about some of the woke capture in academia that sort of contributes to some of this. But the helicopter parenting, the climate anxiety, it's just all contributing to this idea that there's no ability to contact with the external environment and recognize one's place in the larger scheme of things, which is the only thing that matters is your own psyche. We don't matter otherwise. We don't matter to the masses. It just doesn't work that way. And I remember too, just a personal anecdote, you mentioned having to terminate the life of a relative. When I had to put down a cat, and I wouldn't say I'm a regular pet owner, but I've had cats, and I had to put one down in a really urgent situation. They had like what I guess is a feline heart attack. And I remember thinking like, it's still a difficult decision. Like you killed that cat. It was stabilized. It probably would have had some days ahead, but my desire to keep it alive was narcissistic in its own way, right? Like it's like I wanted the cat not for it to survive, but for it to comfort me or to be around for me.
Mm.
And so I thought about that. I wouldn't say you have to confront that possibility, right? Like, because the cat was an attachment object for me, of course. But at the end of the day, if I would have kept him alive for that purpose and brought him back, let's say home, I mean, it was going to be either he would have died soon thereafter, because these things don't typically resolve, or there would have been some miracle. But it would have been cruel to inflict upon the cat continued suffering at my own expense.
I'm putting this in the gender lens for just a second, because I can't help it. That's what we do. When we are affirming the gender identities of these young people, that's almost a similar sort of activity, isn't it?
Activity is to...
Well, I mean, if I'm saying, oh, yeah, I'll help you get testosterone. I'll help you have your breasts removed. I'm a good person because I'm helping you.
Right. Like, so it's feeding your own narcissism. It's feeding your own desire to be validated as a rescuer.
Yeah.
And that's why I say a perversion of the caregiving instinct. Like, if you've seen my regular tweets the last 24 hours, like, I posted some papers that have to do with Munchausen syndrome by proxy. Of course, that's not what this is in the strict sense.
Yeah.
But if you generalize that, it's totally that, right? It's this idea that you're a rescuer confirming your own narcissistic desire to be meaningful in a world where you haven't developed your own meaningfulness in an adaptive way that makes sense. So you're perverting this.
That's when you put it that way, that's horrible.
And you keep them sick. You keep them sick. You need them to be sick so you can rescue them.
Right. That's essentially what Munchausen syndrome by proxy is at its heart. Now, it applied to gender identity, it's a different story. You know, the typical strict definition of that is where there's regular physical harm, you know, and typically it's also, you know, infancy. But the bridge to gender identity is clearly there, right? Like, it's clearly there. This is a personality issue, mental illness. Comorbid, of course, in the children with their own mental illness.
It seems like the only way that you could fix this in the people who are these having this narcissistic caregiving trait is to persuade them that the greatest good that they can do is to let go of their attachment objects.
Right, or to uncover what's driving their own narcissism. I mean, I think if you would see a lot in these, I would venture to hypothesize, and this is research I would love to do, like, if you were to look at some of these ideologues who were the sort of rescuers, if you look into their developmental histories, you're going to see issues with their own parents that are quite notable and outside the ordinary, I think. They're definitely struggling for their own affirmation in a way that is not normative, because you're leveraging a situation in a child that's clearly at odds with empirical reality. I mean, this isn't the parent who wants to feel good because their kid scored 3 goals in soccer. This is much more different. In the face of overwhelming evidence now that it's dangerous and inflicts harm, physical harm, on those who undergo it.
But this is, I don't know if normative is a synonym for normal, but this is so widespread now among parents and teachers.
Right. And I think that's where the role of this social media amplification comes in, this contagion. Women in general, and I speak again generally, not that men aren't, you know, can't experience this, but most of the social contagions throughout history have afflicted women. And when you have social media now where this is propagated at just enormous degree and scope and quickness, the opportunity, and of course even on Facebook with some of these niche groups, the contagion can spread quickly, much more quickly than a world where this didn't exist. It's become widespread in a way through contagion.
Sure.
Well, wear a mask, people.
Wear a brain condom online.
Well, I think some of the pushback is helping on social media, because even if the parents won't admit it, some are starting to wake up. And I think in some of these groups, there's going to be an awakening for some. And once the process, I think somebody was tweeting about this the other night, or somebody mentioned this, once the detransition start, you're going to see a social contagion almost in the opposite direction, where it'll be a more of an adaptive contagion, but it'll still be a contagion nonetheless. And it's just going to be like, it'll be the, you know, the cool thing to detransition, or to say that you realize the wool was pulled over your eyes. And so it's still a contagion, but at least it's a waking up and a shifting of the cultural milieu to a world in which empirical reality is accepted.
You know, another thought now that you say that, which is almost, I regret talking to you, JD, because now I just realized.
I hope that's not a bad thing.
You black-pilled Corinna.
I can't undo this now. It is, I think you're right. I've expected there to be sort of a contagion for detransition, but the victim complex that so many transitioners have is just going to meld so easily into detransition to be a different victim complex.
Yeah, those personality traits that allowed them to become transitioners in the first place, whether that's their comorbid mental illness or confusion or lack of personality integration, is going to exactly be the case for that. So I think the prediction would be that you're going to see this begin to spiral the other way a little bit. And so then you have to say, well, if we really see this victim mindset is leading to the detransitioning, you still have the problem of that victim mindset, but it's at least leading to a detransitioning now and a waking up. And at least you can, through the waking up, it's easier to point out the victimology and the victim mindset that exists for them to sort of address through programs or teaching or whatever, to get them the assistance that they need.
They need structure. They need to know that they're detransitioning, not because they're following other detransitioners, but because that there's something that they're trying to achieve in order to continue developing a healthy personality complex.
Right. And that's where it gets to the lunacy of like the concept of gender fluidity. There is none. And so it becomes easier to point out that when especially in the case of detransition, where some sort of physical alteration was made, it's such a severe adjustment to one's soma, one's body, that the ability to use that as a dramatic category to address the individual becomes much more pragmatic and practical, because they've done something that is in many cases unalterable. So the point of reachability is increased at that point. They can begin then to develop a coherent understanding of why, what in the hell they did what they did, assuming that whatever biological issue they may be struggling with or comorbid mental illness is addressed at the same time. I mean, most of this is depression. So these would be my broad sketches of how to reach this issue. And that's kind of what I'm trying to do. Like I was never, this issue is one for me because I study mental illness and the structure of it. I'm not a clinician, but I can see from what I've done how this all plays out. And I think too, my background in attachment theory has been helpful, because a lot of this is trauma in some respects, mixing with biological predisposition. You're asking these really mega questions of how do we correct this issue? And I think in this discussion, we've kind of begun to unravel some of the ways in which we can more effectively do that. And that's all in the context of the discussion of the book, which comes down to, you know, the denial of death is sort of the title. But at the end of the day, it's really about coherent identity formation. Religion provides that for many, but that's waned. Secular society, and especially now with social media, And social media is driving a lot of the gender identity disturbance. But at the end of the day, it comes down to contact with external reality and developing a sense of personality integration that is becoming, I think, increasingly harder in today's world. And once you mix that in with mental illness and social media, you can see what we end up with.
Can you talk more about religion? Like, it seems like...
Well, I think the religion, at the end of the day, Judeo-Christianity especially, but Islam too, it's structural. It provides structure for the common masses. Go to church, tradition, routine, repetition. It structures the environment for others who, you know, let's say you don't have the intellectual persona. It's a way for people to get through life in a way that allows them to not fear death, right? Like not fear existential dread, because the tradition, the routine provides them with some sort of fulcrum to live their life. And of course you have the promise of eternal salvation in Judeo-Christianity, but that's sort of, to me, incidental to the structure and routine that it provides in the here and now. And when that wanes, something else needs to come in place of that. We, you know, the democratization of education, people can see some of the gaps in religion and other religions come to the fore, but none of those religions have the structure and the, you know, the history of these deep, rich religious traditions with traditions around holidays. And when that wanes, that's when the existential dread comes in. And if you don't have, let's say, a structured caregiving environment with two parents to provide some structure, or one parent, or even adoptive parents. But if you have a lack of caregiving at the most general sense, you're in a world that's just total chaos. And Winnicott would say, like, you're the person, the young child is just falling forever. They don't know what's happening. It's psychic chaos. And so, more generally, that's what religion did, was it provided a way for structure to orient the person towards existence where they didn't have to consider a world that was just totally chaotic. And so I think that's the sort of appeal. And you see in the review, which I link a lot of that existential despair and lack of religion to what gave rise to this pseudo-religion in the first place of gender identity. When religion wanes, something else has got to fit in for the masses, because the masses just, you know, the masses might not be as educated. We think of ourselves as the masses, but we're not. Like, I mean, it's only a small fragment of the population that is really highly educated, and even more or less that are able to have the background to consider the reality that their existence is nothing aside from themselves and still retain an integration to go about their daily life. That requires a really highly developed personality. And so the masses just don't have that.
Come on, guys, get with it. Come on, listeners.
Well, it's interesting.
Integrate.
It's interesting that your description of religion didn't involve any, like, spirituality side. It involved...
Well, I mean, I was raised Catholic. And so, I mean, I can see the structural element there. I mean, I guess in terms of spirituality, that's the Causa Sui project, right? Like, that's the element of spirituality in Becker's Denial of Death, is that if you have this idea of yourself, something that's going to live beyond you, that's the spirituality there, right? Like, you have this notion that who you were is going to live beyond your earthly existence. And so that's where the spirituality comes in. Not that you're going to have eternal salvation in some utopia, but that your skin mark is going to remain, right? So I think that's where the spirituality comes in.
I'm an artist. And
well, but, okay, that's a great example, though, right? Like, because you're producing art that will live beyond you.
Yeah.
You're producing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I mean, it's great. It's been really, it's saved my life and all that sort of stuff. But I have to acknowledge that it will vanish also. Like, I will vanish before all of my art does, but my art is going to vanish as well. And memories of me are also going to vanish.
Correct, but those memories will have a trail. Your art will vanish, but it will influence others who will then carry that forward in a legacy. So your art may physically vanish, but its imprint upon other minds that will transcend and transcend downstream will not.
Absolutely. That is why I am a free culture advocate, and that is why I derive so much meaning and even like spiritual comfort from the sharing of culture, because that's what it does. It propagates through us, and it is like, I do not have biological children. I've never wanted them. I reproduce culturally. I am influenced by the culture around me, and new things come out of me influenced by that. And I love their having lives of their own and spreading, and yeah.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, I would say I'm similar in that sense. I think we're, not that I've never wanted kids, but I've never felt a strong urge, like most, even some of the hockey players that I grew up with, like that was their mission, to have a family. And, you know, they were the highly masculine men too. And I consider myself highly masculine, but I've never had an overwhelming drive to have a family. I think for me, it's been competition to publish, and, you know, kind of, it's just more of that competitive element. But at the same time, I want my science and legacy to live on somehow.
Well, speaking of your legacy, isn't this a perfect segue,
perfect
Nina?
Perfect segue.
For our listeners who would like to know more about your writings, your works, your viewpoints, where can they go to follow?
I would say, and I'm looking at this right now, I would say X, Twitter, is by far and away the most primary way of finding out about me, at JD Haltian. And that will, in the bio of my X feed is my Substack, which I'm using as sort of my pseudo scientific platform right now because of the corruption of the universities. But it's where I speak most freely, where I develop my intellectual thought, where I seek pushback to my intellectual thought. It's how I met both of you. And it's, you know, I try not to do all the podcast requests that I get, because it's really an issue now for me of money and time, given that I don't have the institutional support. But this is crucial. The crucial to get this word out too. I think a lot of parents who needing to hear it and who are looking for guideposts and some structure to grab hold of. So at X, if you could promote that, and my Substack as well, which I know both of you, you know, have the address to. That's crucial for me right now in this sort of unstable time for me. And then, of course, when the podcast comes out, I will amplify that as well. But not only do I see it's important for me, people to get to know my thought, but I think it's important for the overall mission of getting back to a sane place in our society.
And your Substack is at your website. I think I pronounced your name wrong. I apologize. Is the G silent?
No, Haltigan.
Haltigan. Okay. My ears don't work. So it's JDHALTIGAN.com if you want to get to a Substack called The Multilevel Mailer.
That's correct. And that there's a link to that in my X bio. So if you click on my X feed, you'll see that website right up there. Underneath my banner there. Hopefully Elon isn't suppressing me too much for that, but I don't think it's been too bad. So,
all right. Well, thank you so much.
Well, thank you both. And I'm really glad. This is one of the better podcasts in the sense of I felt like I was able to unpack my own thoughts a little bit better. But I guess over time, as you do more podcasts, as sort of a quote-unquote public intellectual, you become better. But I was really able to unpack some thoughts in a more coherent way than I feel like I had before. So thank you both for pulling that out of me.
Yeah, made sense to me.
Yeah. Had a few epiphanies there, Corinna.
I did. I have to go think about this and ruminate and try to connect some of these learnings today and try to figure out if there's some way that I can leverage them.
Well, I will be interested to hear what you have to say, because you've already helped me in many ways with some of my own thinking, so I appreciate it.
Oh, very kind.
Well,
Turfs and Trannies,
thanks for listening.
All right, bye.
Bye.
Hey, everybody. Thank you for listening to Heterodorks. You can support us by visiting our page at anchor.fm/heterodorks or by supporting Nina Paley at patreon.com/Nina Paley. You can also support us by writing a review on your favorite podcast site, such as Apple Podcasts. Thank you.